Welcome to the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, where you'll get actionable tips and advice on major gifts, direct response fundraising, legacy giving, and much more from leading experts in the nonprofit sector. Now, here are your hosts of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, Andrew Olson and Roy Jones.
Hey, everyone. Welcome. This is Andrew Olson with my colleague and co-host, Roy Jones, host of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast. We're really excited to be with you today. And we are super excited to have Mark McIntyre as our guest today. Mark has lived and worked in the DC area for the last 33 years. And during that time, Mark has done so many things. He's worked for Congress. He's worked in the White House. He's helped build the largest privately owned government relations agency in history. Today, Mark's co-founder of Merchant McIntyre and Associates, and they're a leading federal grants agency that exclusively serves nonprofit organizations. During his 33-year career, Mark and his team have helped secure hundreds of million dollars for all sorts of different nonprofit organizations through the federal government. And in fact, I believe at a time, Roy might have even been a client of Mark's.
I have to admit, I was, and that's how I, you know, first indirectly met you, Andrew. We reached out to Mark's agency, and they helped us when I was director of development get about, I think it was about $12 million worth of government funding programs. So I have to plead guilty.
There you go.
Mark, welcome. It's good to have you.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, Roy. Good to be on with you guys again.
Hey, you know, man, it's not lost on us that yesterday, former President George Herbert Walker Bush, you know, Bush 41 was laid to rest. And if I'm not mistaken, your time in the White House, actually, you had the distinct privilege of serving as a speechwriter for Bush 41, didn't you?
I did, and it's really kind of you to ask. I've heard from family and friends for the last several days since his passing, and what I tell folks is I'm joyful for the life that he lived, and I feel blessed to have served him. So I was with him primarily when he was vice president. I served as his chief speechwriter. And am I allowed to just share one anecdote that I'd like to share with people to give you a sense of who he is?
Love to hear it.
Yeah. So back in the day, if you worked on the vice president's staff, and that's all the way down to the mail carrier, literally. If you worked on the vice president's staff and Air Force Two was traveling to your hometown, then you were on the plane and you were in the motorcade to the event. Once you got to the event, the vice president and Mrs. Bush, if she made the trip, would go to a holding room briefly, and the first people they would greet would be your family.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
It really is. And obviously, there was absolutely no requirement for him to do that, but it was clearly the desire of his heart. If you worked for George Bush, he always knew your name. He always said thank you. And I was in close proximity with him for 26 months, going through what by definition is 24/7 stress of a presidential campaign, and I never saw him lose his temper. So, quite a guy.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that, man. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
So, you know, if we pivot from that, I mean, given your experience and the kind of work that you do, you know, thinking about the last few months, our country has gone through maybe one of the most contentious midterm elections that at least I've ever seen. You know, Democrats made huge gains. They've now got a lock on the House of Representatives, but the Republicans added, you know, to their seats in the Senate, and we all know that, you know, they hold the White House for at least the next couple of years. I don't know, in my travels in and out of D.C. in the last couple of months, I don't know if I've ever experienced just a weirder political state of being and such a contentious, you know, narrative going on across the country. And I'm curious for our nonprofit listeners who are seeking federal support, who are seeking, you know, whether that be funding or through for legislative priorities, you know, as an expert in this area, Mark, what do you suggest and how would you counsel nonprofits to effectively navigate this fractured political landscape to still achieve their objectives, even though there's such a stalemate going on?
Absolutely. There is a lot of political noise. And of course, the media seems to simply fan the flames. So what I like to remind people, including my clients, is that there are tens of thousands of congressional staff people and administration staff people, by the way, like the federal program officers who oversee competitive and discretionary grant programs, and they're focused 100% on doing their jobs. It may surprise people to hear this, but most federal workers pay little or no attention to the political noise. There's a fundamental and compelling reason for this, right? So members of Congress, congressional staff, and the political appointees of any administration are a passing parade. They're not a standing army. It's the career federal employees, like the federal program officers who oversee grants, that are the permanent government. So the political noise for them is largely sound and fury signifying nothing. You know, since the 24/7 cable news media portrays DC like we've all lost our minds, I just want to share with you a conversation I had with my wife Lisa back in January of 2016, shortly after the president was inaugurated. Lisa called me during the workday and she said, "Well, where are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm up on Capitol Hill. I'm in the Hart Senate office building." And she said, "Wow, it must be crazy there. What's it like?" And I said, "Lisa, I've been coming to Capitol Hill on a regular basis since I arrived in D.C. on June 23rd, 1985. And I have to tell you that this place looks and feels exactly like it did when I arrived 33 years ago." I said to her, I'm in the atrium. Young, you know, the typical House staffer is 26.8 years of age, right? So I'm looking at these young Senate staffers checking their phones as they hurry from meeting to meeting, many of them thinking that whatever assignment they're working on is the single most important assignment in D.C. So again, what I like to encourage folks is the media focuses on scandal. The media focuses on, you know, the political intrigue. Obviously, in recent, really for the last 2 years, they focused on the Mueller investigation. And most of that stuff has no relevance to the federal program officers who oversee federal grants. So just wanted to share that.
Well, that should be a welcome piece of news for most nonprofits that are looking to engage the federal government, I got to think.
Well, mm-hmm. And of course, I remember even 18 months ago, I mean, the whole world was falling apart in the nonprofit world. You know, we were going to lose literally billions of dollars in donations because of the Trump tax plan. And sometimes we fall prey to that political noise you talk about, Mark. Of course, none of that happened. As a matter of fact, just the opposite has happened. Donations have increased dramatically in the last 18 months across the board. And it's really interesting. I think you're so right just about ignoring the political noise and do your job because everybody else is doing theirs.
Well, exactly. And that's a good example of how nonprofits, when there is a legislative proposal that is unfriendly to them. You know, we live in a great country where under the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, every citizen has the right to, quote, petition the Congress. And nowhere does it say in the U.S. Constitution that we get extra style points for doing that alone, which is exactly why people hire lobbyists, exactly why people retain Merchant McIntyre Associates, so that we can help people achieve their objectives at the federal level, despite whatever political noise is going on. And by the way, since the Congress has the sole power of the federal purse, which means that all of these dollars that flow from federal grants ultimately comes from the Congress, it's worth pointing out a fact that the media never reports, which is the federal government every year passes 12 appropriations bills. So this year we will have spent $4.4 trillion with a T. And by definition, to pass 12 separate appropriations bills, the Congress must do that in a bipartisan way. And so the media, of course, always wants to report on the division. And the reality is the way the government functions year in and year out, whether you pass an appropriation bill or say the next big piece of legislation that they want to do this year before recessing is the farm bill, by definition, it's bipartisan.
So Mark, I want to go a little bit into the weeds with you for a second. As you know, Roy leads the major gift program at Mercy Ships, you know, one of the largest international medical service providers and faith-based nonprofits in the country. And I work with organizations of all shapes and sizes, from international relief to healthcare to homeless services and things like that. And I'm curious, based on the sheer diversity of the nonprofit sector in the U.S., I'd love to hear about the trends that you all are seeing in D.C. right now around federal funding priorities and the kinds of organizations mm-hmm. that are getting funded and those that aren't, and maybe what some of the biggest differences are between those two groups.
Yeah. So you really asked two or three really big questions there. So let me tell you a little bit about the trends that we see, and that alone requires perhaps a lengthy answer. So interrupt me if you want to go deeper in another area. Sound good?
Sounds good.
Yeah. So you know, in the years ahead, this administration and the Congress are going to make major investments in healthcare, job training and workforce development, specifically apprenticeships, STEM, which of course is science, technology, engineering, mathematics, at not just research institutions, but non-research institutions, economic development, campus security, infrastructure, and public safety. Probably the most dramatic federal investment in the nonprofit sector will be in healthcare. The government will spend trillions of dollars in the years ahead to expand access, improve care, and lower costs. For example, under the Affordable Care Act, the Congress authorized $10 billion, with a B, for the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. We call it colloquially the Innovation Center. And so that's a large, still relatively new source of federal funding that has already been authorized. So again, just to give you a sense of how powerful it is to pursue federal dollars, we represented a 24-bed critical access hospital in Montana, a very rural hospital. And in the first round of the Innovation Center funding, they had 3,000 applications and they made 106 awards. And our client, Mineral Community Hospital, won a $10.4 million award. So think about that, $10.4 million to help a rural 24-bed critical access hospital. And this is after we had helped them with a $600,000 grant and a $900,000 grant. So we view the federal government as the largest potential major donor on planet Earth, because year in and year out, it's going to spend $4.4 trillion, hundreds of billions of dollars of that at the nonprofit. They're going to invest hundreds of billions of dollars in the nonprofit sector.
So I want to pause there for a second, because when I think, before really kind of going deep with you on how this process works, you know, I was mm-hmm. pretty naive about it. And I've heard other nonprofit, you know, executives and development officers have a similar point of view, and treating a federal grant request and the federal, you know, approaching the federal government in general, the same way you might a pro forma foundation grant request, where it's, you know, you fill out the document and you ship it off and you hope for the best. But hearing you describe mm-hmm. them as the world's largest major donor, I mean, Roy, it's got to be ringing in your ears too. I mean, I start to think about what's the white glove treatment that we bring? What's the actual moves management strategy mm-hmm. that wraps around a federal grant request to ensure that you get the best result possible?
Mm. Yeah, when I was working at the university and a client of Mark's, I mean, the hardest thing for my peers to understand there was that the process, you know, it's not like an annual grant process. For the most part, you know, you've got appropriations and authorizations, and oftentimes that's a two-year hop to get to where you want to go. Mark, thoughts?
Well, you know, what I tell folks is that the great fact about pursuing federal grants is how much money you can secure, and you can get just a phenomenal return on investment. The bad news is that the federal government always moves slower than we would like them to, except when they collect their taxes, right? So the first and biggest mistake that most leaders of nonprofit institutions and organizations make is that they never try, right? They quit before they start. My sense is that most people out in the real world, right? Because DC is not the real world, but my sense is that most people in the real world view the federal government as a large, impenetrable monolith. And the reality is the opposite. The federal agencies are highly permeable. Washington, D.C. operates like a small town. Everyone knows everyone. So if the president of a university or the CEO of a hospital or the mayor of a municipality wants to win a federal grant, the federal program officers will actually tell you what they're looking for in an award-worthy submission. You just need to take the initiative to schedule the meeting and then ask the right questions. And of course, that's the beginning of the process, but the dollars are there to be had, just like when you pursue a major gift from a potential donor, right? There's a process that you go through and you simply need to work the process.
Yeah. So some give up before they get through the process, don't they?
Well, most of them do. Right. I mean, if I were to say to a nonprofit leader how to get started, and by the way, Merchant McIntyre Associates represents primarily the have-nots when it comes to federal dollars. And what I mean by that is we typically represent institutions and organizations that either have never received a federal grant or have received only a few. So we typically don't represent, you know, the Johns Hopkins universities of the world. They already get about $400 million a year on their own. They have a huge internal grants staff. They don't need us. But most folks, right, are not Johns Hopkins, right? Most people are looking at the federal government thinking, wow, I know that they give a lot of grant money. How do I access it? So the first thing you need to do is do a little homework online about what federal grants are available in your category, right? So analyze whether your programs align with the mission of any federal grant programs. And then contact the appropriate federal program officers, right? Typically, their names are online associated with the grants over which they have jurisdiction. And ask them the questions you have about what they're looking for in an award-worthy application. And then if you're a nonprofit institutional leader, you then need to decide whether your organization has the internal capacity to pursue federal grants or whether you need to retain outside expertise.
So Mark, as we've been talking about this, you know, one of the things that excuse me, that I wanted to go back to is you mentioned not trying, not starting as sort of the biggest mistakes. What are some of the other distinctions that you see between organizations that are successful and win grant awards,
right,
and those that aren't?
Yeah. In our agency, we talk about the three P's: people, programs, and partnerships. So the nonprofit institutions and organizations that win federal grants typically have the right people, the right programs, and the right partnerships. By that I mean you have people internally, again, whether you're a college, a university, hospital, medical center, homeless shelter, international NGO, you have people internally who, if they receive federal dollars, can actually serve as good stewards of those dollars, right? In terms of programs, it's what I talked about earlier, actually doing some homework online and then following up with conversations with the program officers. If you have programs that you think align with a federal program, so for example, rescue missions, if they do transitional living programs, right, the Administration for Children and Family has a TLP grant, Transitional Living Program grant, right? You read through the information online about the grant to ask yourself whether you want to borrow the trouble of pursuing that grant. And then many federal grant programs require strong partnerships. And these are not, you know, these are not handshakes. These are not, you know, I know the friend of a friend of a friend at the Chamber of Commerce. These are formal, viable, visible partnerships that say a university or a hospital has with folks in their community to, again, to actually implement a grant award if it's given. So again, the three categories that, to answer your question, the three key components are the people, the programs, and the partnerships.
That's good stuff. So tell me this, Mark. You know, when I think about some of the organizations that you and I have talked about that have won grants or that have lost them, are there in the grant seeking process? Let's assume that you have the three P's. Are there other sort of typical missteps that organizations make that keep them from being able to access federal funding?
I have two thoughts. First, attention to detail is typically helpful. And in the category of federal grants, it's essential. So it's essential for whoever is writing the grant to be responsive to the criteria of the grant, right? Line by line, heading by heading, requirement by requirement, right? So you write to the grant. We talk about when you apply for a federal grant, your competitor is yourself, right? Your competitor is how well am I answering the questions or the criteria on this grant? That's point number one. Point number two is the federal grants process is a great process for people who don't take no for an answer easily, right? So most people, I don't know about you guys, but most people I know, including myself, You don't go through life undefeated. So if you're committed to pursuing any endeavor, and today we're talking about federal grants, you got to be willing to overcome an initial no. So again, let me just give you a brief real life anecdote that happened last year. So my business partner Brent Merchant is what we call an EDA wizard. By that I mean Economic Development Administration grant wizard. Because you actually engage the regional staff and it's a co-create process as opposed to just writing quietly in your office against the grant. And so he called an EDA representative in Missouri because we were working on behalf of a partnership between a hospital and a local educational institution. So note that partnership, right? Partnerships are essential. And the initial response he got from the regional EDA representative was, quote, your proposed project is ineligible, right? Your proposed project does not cut the mustard. And so Brent engaged this person, shared the workforce development needs of that part of the country, which like a lot of areas in the U.S. has a nursing shortage. And that initial conversation took place in July. In December, our client got a letter from the Economic Development Administration that said that the award was approved, and it said your project is approved without caveats, meaning without revisions. $2.2 million workforce development grant from the EDA. So another interesting aspect of this story is, the Economic Development Administration actually will fund a hospital project? Yeah, because they're going to create jobs in the years to come. And of course, Brent did not take no for an answer. And 6 months later, after a lot of work, we won the grant.
You know, it's so funny. I mean, Roy, we talk all the time about the resilience needed in major gift development, right? And it sounds to me, I mean, this sounds like it's the exact same thing, you know, slightly different model, slightly different type of donor, but really it's about, do you have that internal willingness to let a door slam in your face and then go knock on it again, right?
I think it really is. I mean, it's as much about getting in line and determining to stay in line, as it is the expertise in the grant writing piece. You know, of course, that's what folks like Mark can help with, is to make sure you get that right. You can learn that. But the tenacity required is often something you can't teach. And I see it so often, people just give up too soon.
Yeah. Mark, you know, if I'm a nonprofit executive director and I think I want to try my hand at securing federal grant dollars, is there a process or a tip sheet or something like that that you go through that you could say, you know, hey, organization A, if you want to do this, go through this process and you know, kind of check under the hood at your organization for these things, and you know, that'll kind of give you a guideline for whether you're ready or not?
Well, the short answer is no. There's not a tip sheet, but just building on what I said earlier, right? You want to evaluate your internal capacity. So that goes back to people, programs, and partnerships. There's a lot of information online from the agencies about what they're willing to fund. And I think very few people ever evaluate this process from the perspective of a federal program officer. All of our clients, right, 100% of our clients are surprised what happens when we take them in to meet with a federal program officer. They're amazed at how honest and open and vulnerable they are about how to win their grant. So just stop and think about that for a moment. Whether you work at the Department of Health and Human Services, Homeland Security, Education, Department of Justice, you're a federal program officer. Your job is to deliver wins for yourself, for your boss, for your department, for the agency. A friend of mine named Steve, I saw him recently. I said, Steve, you know, I apologize for asking this question. I probably asked it, you know, several times before, but tell me again why you came to DC. He said, same reason you did. I said, really? What's that? He said, didn't you come to DC to change the world? So you have these dedicated public servants who oversee these federal grant programs. And I've never had a conversation with one of them where they sit down and they say, Mark, I'm so glad you're here. Let's figure out how we can waste some money today. Right? They want to fund worthy projects, and they will tell you what it takes to win their grant. Some nonprofit leaders think that they're too small to win a grant. Some nonprofit leaders think that they're in an area that's too rural or too economically depressed. There are Christ-centered nonprofit leaders who think the federal government will not fund what I do, or if they do, there's too much red tape involved to take the dollars. And all of those obstacles are actually false, right? Being a smaller nonprofit can be an advantage depending on the grant. Hospitals and municipalities, and in some cases, higher educational institutions in a rural area, you actually get points for something the federal government calls rurality. Being in an economically depressed area actually qualifies you for certain grants. And there are federal program officers at various agencies who have told us, they've actually told us at Merchant McIntyre Associates, that they don't have a Christ-centered institution organization in their portfolio. And so they've asked us, do you represent any Christ-centered organizations that would be good candidates for this award program? So that just gives, again, that just gives you a deeper sense of the possibilities if you're willing to engage these potential donors who happen to be, by the way, you know, they're spending our taxpayer dollars, these federal program officers who we view as potential major donors.
It's so interesting to me to hear you make that point about, you know, faith-based and Christ-centered organizations. I think so often we think about the federal government with respect to the narrative around separation of church and state, and the idea that, you know, if you're a faith-based nonprofit, you really ought to be arm's length from the government. And it sounds like what you're saying is, not only is that not the case, but the government is actively seeking out opportunities to fund and serve organizations like that.
Well, that's exactly right. I've lived in DC now for 33 years, as you said at the outset. And what I've experienced firsthand is that members of Congress, congressional staff, and federal program officers realize that faith-based institutions and faith-based organizations often are more effective than secular organizations. And so they're leaning forward to invest in them. I've had many conversations with the college president of Christ-centered institutions. And one of the first questions I ask them is, do you receive federal dollars? And the answer is, no, we don't. I said, really? Do you have any financial aid students? Oh, yeah, we got, you know, 43% of our student body is financial aid students. Really? Really? Okay. What kind of grants are they? Right. And of course, you know where I'm headed here. They're Stafford grants or Pell grants. They're all federal grants. And so if you're a college or university and you are accepting federal dollars through these loan programs and you receive additional federal dollars through a competitive grant program, there is no additional burden. The reason I use that phrase, no additional burden, is because a couple of decades ago, we retained the services of a guy named Dr. Carl Esbeck, was and perhaps still is a constitutional expert. He worked in John Ashcroft's Department of Justice, and that was the phrase that he used in his little memorandum describing why, if you are a college or university, you accept federal dollars through financial aid, you accept federal dollars through what used to be called earmarks, legislatively driven grants, or competitive or discretionary grants.
Cool. Thanks for that. I think as we're wrapping up, I've got just one more question for you. And that's really around sort of your guidance to nonprofits who say, you know what, I think I'm ready to start. So I would just ask, you know, what one or two nuggets would you share either to help motivate or to help guide an organization that thinks they're ready to start that journey?
My first encouragement would be it's achievable, right? It's absolutely positively possible to secure federal dollars. There are thousands of institutions and organizations that do it every year. Back in 2004, a pitcher named Curt Schilling showed up at the Red Sox. He'd been traded by the Arizona Diamondbacks, who had just defeated the Yankees in the World Series. And he walked into the clubhouse in Boston and realized that the Red Sox had a really good team. He also realized that they hadn't won a World Series in 86 years. And he looked at his new teammates and said, why not us? And that became the rallying cry. And I'm not a huge baseball fan, but I know that in 2004, the Red Sox won the World Series. And of course, they've won two or three since then. It turned it around. So I would encourage the leaders of nonprofits to think to themselves, why not us? And I'm an interested party because, you know, my name is on the door. But just like other professional services, it's often essential to retain expertise, whether it's major donor development, direct response marketing, or what we're talking about today, federal grants.
On that note, Mark, for our listeners who are motivated by this conversation and curious, maybe want to take a stab at this or at least have a conversation about it, if someone wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way for folks to reach you?
Yeah. So, by the way, we at Merchant McIntyre Associates love what we do. We are passionate about serving nonprofits that feed people, house people, educate people, and heal people. And so the best way to reach me, I'm even brave enough to give you my cell phone number, 202-657-7556. Probably better to text me. Or my email address is my first initial M, last name McIntyre, at merchantmcintyre.com. And of course, you can find us on what my dad likes to call the interweb.
Awesome. Well, Mark, thank you again. Appreciate you making time for us, sharing your insights, and helping to provide some additional guidance to nonprofit leaders who are curious about federal funding. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, Roy.
Thank you, Mark.
Really appreciate it. Yep. Bye now.
Bye, guys.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, brought to you exclusively by Newport One. Newport One can make a difference in your fundraising so that you can change the world. You can always reach us at podcast@newportone.com. Please take a moment to rate this episode on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. When you rate this episode, it will help more nonprofit leaders just like you to help find us and get the information that they need to raise more funds for their organization. Thanks again for listening today.